decline.
Thanks very much indeed, Petrok. Tonight, the Russian National Orchestra pays a visit to the proms with conductor Andrei Boryeko. This year is the 20th anniversary of the founding of this orchestra, one of the cultural powerhouses that emerged in Russia after perestroika. From the start, this band broke all the rules. The first orchestra in Russia with no state support, it was set up by Mikhail Pletnyov, a pianist with very little conducting experience. Later on, its artistic policies were developed collectively through a number of different conductors who shared the podium. It's a formula that has certainly worked. From the word go, these players have proved to be one of the world's great ensembles. Tonight's conductor certainly thinks so.
In my opinion, it's the best Russian orchestra at the moment. It's my opinion. From the culture of playing, from intonation, from rhythmical perfection, which was never actually the very strong side of the old Russian orchestra, except of maybe Mravinsky Orchestra. Our strong side was in something different, in emotions, in big arcs. That was the strong side of the Russian orchestra. But now we have both. We have Russian emotionality and we have also the culture of playing and beautiful sound.
Andrei Boryeko, who first started conducting the Russian National Orchestra in the mid-1990s before he went off to work in Europe. Tonight, then, is a bit of a reunion, their first concert together for 9 years. And they'll be performing three works, Tchaikovsky's Third Suite and Rachmaninoff's Rhapsody on a Theme of Paganini. They'll be joined for that by the pianist Nikolai Lugansky. And to start this evening, a great curtain raiser for the fireworks to come. It's Beethoven's Coriolan Overture, as muscular a piece as he ever wrote. It was based on a second-hand account of Shakespeare's Coriolanus, and Beethoven's music is a stormy ride, mirroring the drama of the original play. Well, Beethoven wrote the piece around the same time as the Fifth Symphony. This is around the middle period, so Beethoven very firmly putting the 18th century musical world behind him, the world of people like his heroes, Haydn. This music is stormy, it's tempestuous, it explores the very depths of human behaviour and emotion. Well, don't forget you can get more information on this piece, indeed all of the works in tonight's concert. You just need to log on to our website. It's bbc.co.uk/proms, where you'll find full programme notes that you can download for your delectation and delight. So here now, coming onto the platform, is Andrei Boryeko to conduct the Russian National Orchestra in Beethoven's Coriolan Overture. Well, music that hits you like a punch on the nose. Once it's got your attention, it certainly doesn't let go. Opening their prom tonight, the Russian National Orchestra with Beethoven's Coriolan Overture. And leading the orchestra tonight, their concertmaster Alexei Bruni. They were conducted by Andrei Borieko. So, next up tonight, when is a rhapsody not a rhapsody? Arguably, when it's written by Sergei Rachmaninoff. He's not necessarily the first composer you go to for highly wrought musical architecture. More, he's a man with a reputation for luxurious romanticism, smooth, glistening pieces that radiate colour. But his rhapsody on a theme of Paganini is a brilliant piece of construction. It's a set of 24 variations for piano and orchestra based on a caprice, a little violin piece by Paganini. The final result isn't improvisatory or rhapsodic at all in the traditional sense. Well, like so many composers, Rachmaninoff was drawn to the music of Paganini, the 18th century Italian violin virtuoso whose legend had a powerful hold on the romantic imagination. It was rumoured that Paganini had given his soul to the devil and that his violin strings were made out of his wife's intestines, which he had had cut out especially for the purpose. Well, regardless of the truth of all that, Paganini's music was certainly devilish to play, and his caprices, with their daring virtuosic demands, attracted a whole host of other composers to reimagine them. Brahms, Liszt, Schumann all had a go at reworking the 24th caprice, but Rachmaninoff went a step further, weaving Paganini's original with the Dies Irae, the medieval chant for the dead. In doing so, he made a piece that combined mercurial flights of technical brilliance with elements of satire, jazz, and an eerie sense of doom. Earlier today, I talked to tonight's soloist Nikolai Lugansky. He's a great champion of Rachmaninoff's music, and I asked him why.
You know, if you love somebody, it's not easy to answer the question why you love. I love this music. For me, is greatest Russian musician, Russian composer, not only composer, of course, pianist and conductor, whoever lived. But why I love Rachmaninoff, it's not easy to say. I love to play his music always. I never felt that I'm tired of playing Rachmaninoff. It's always for me happiness, and I feel really at home playing Rachmaninoff.
What is it about this piece that are the particular highlights and the challenges for you?
This is a really brilliant concert piece. It's just opposite to concerto which he composed before, number 4, which is very deep, very sad, very dark music. Of course, it needs very virtuosic dialogue between piano and orchestra. It seems like it's very rhythmic, it's very easy, it's not. It needs a really virtuosity, very often in quick tempo, but virtuosity when you immediately react on a phrase. And this, let's say, good and bad, the darkness and light, is very clear in this music, very strong.
Tonight's soloist, Nikolai Lugansky. And here he is with conductor Andrei Borieko to join the Russian National Orchestra. Music by Rachmaninoff, a rhapsody on a theme of Paganini.
Thank you. Thank you.
thrilling, frenzied sprint to the finish there. Rachmaninoff's Rhapsody on a theme of Paganini. The soloist tonight here at the 2010 BBC Proms was Nikolai Lugansky. The Russian National Orchestra, conducted by Andrei Borieko. Leading the orchestra tonight, their concertmaster, Alexei Bruni. And conductors, soloists, holding hands, bowing. Well, that piece by Rachmaninoff has often been called his fifth concerto in all but name. Certainly tonight's soloist thinks that. He told me earlier today it's got every element of a concerto. Soloist and orchestra engaged in the most vivid dialogue. He described it as music full of colour and wit, lyricism, virtuosity. And here he is back on stage, Nikolai Lugansky. Supremely busy man, just to give you a vague idea of his schedule. Tomorrow he's off to Berlin, open air concert in Potsdam. He's just recorded a Chopin disc. Doing two Chopin concertos in Moscow soon. He was going to take a holiday, but he decided to make a recording with Vadim Repin instead. Yeah, they've recently recorded sonatas by Franck, Grieg, Janáček. They recorded that in July, when Lugansky was due to take his two-week annual holiday, but he gave it up. And now all the members of the Russian National Orchestra on their feet. Much tapping of bows in the string section. Their warm appreciation for tonight's soloist, Nikolai Lugansky. Well, Lugansky's teacher in Russia was Tatiana Nikolaeva. She's one of the most influential piano teachers. She said she sees him as the natural successor to people like Richter and Emil Gilel. So, a lot of responsibility on this young man's shoulders. And boy, do the audience here love him. They won't let him go. Much stamping of feet as tonight's soloist is back on stage. Will he be giving us some more music, we wonder? Thank you. from Rachmaninoff's set of Preludes, Opus 32, that was number 12. It was played live here at the BBC Proms by Nikolai Lugansky. He is such a great champion, such a great performer of the music of Rachmaninoff. He's recorded so much of it, all the concertos, various Preludes, Moments Musicaux. He's recorded the Rhapsody we've just heard. And an absolutely thrilling performance of that Rhapsody here at the Proms this evening. Well, this is the man who stormed to the winning prize of the International Tchaikovsky Competition in 1994, one of the most prestigious piano competitions in the world. And since then, he has not looked back. What a way to close the first half of tonight's Proms. So far this evening, we've heard the Russian National Orchestra in two very muscular pieces, Beethoven and Rachmaninoff. After the interval, we step into the rather gentler world of Tchaikovsky and an orchestral score inspired by a summer holiday in Ukraine. It's Tchaikovsky's Third Suite, and that is still to come this evening. Before that, fiction from the pen of the writer Irène Némirovsky. Our interval feature is Monsieur Rose. It's taken from Dimanche and Other Stories, the first collection of Némirovsky's short stories to appear in English. It tells the story of a well-heeled Frenchman who's forced to flee and leave his old life behind as chaos and panic take hold at the onset of the Second World War.
He was as aloof and self-contained as a cat. His life was an easy one. He had never married, and he was rich. Ever since he was a child, his face had had a condescending, mocking expression that inspired respect. He was well into his 50s, with nice, plump cheeks, a sharp, authoritative voice, a discreet manner, and a pointed wit. He cared for no one. He hated no one. He managed his fortune remarkably well. He lived on the Boulevard Malherbe in the house where he was born. He approved of simple pleasures, strolls, reading, the same liqueur drunk at the same time every evening in the same quiet bar. He thought that one should plan ahead, weigh things up, be wary of the unknown. He was happy to admit that this was not always easy, but patiently he tried to ward off misfortune. His greatest concern was where to invest his money and how to avoid heavy taxes. He had anticipated the war of 1940, and he had been taking precautions since 1930, although these were not always successful. "I've lost a few feathers," he confided to his close friends in 1932, "but better a feather than the whole bird." Very early on, he decided to sell the buildings he owned in Paris. He was a little ashamed to admit that he was frightened of air raids. Quietly, he finalized some deals, as always, without making or losing too much money. He chose a delightful spot in Normandy where he bought a well-appointed house with a large garden. After the Anschluss in 1938, he had his collection of porcelain sent there. When German troops marched into Prague, Monsieur Rose had his glassware and pictures packed away. He was also one of the first Frenchmen to acquire a gas mask. In spite of all this, he remained an optimist and declared cheerfully that everything would be fine. Then it was 1939, and Monsieur Rose slept less and less. He foresaw disasters ahead. Along with everyone else, he talked about necessity and the nobility of sacrifice. He was happy to talk forcefully about the citizens' obligations and rights, but in his mind there was an essential difference between himself and other people. He left the obligations to them, keeping only the rights for himself. He saw the world through the prism of his own preoccupations. At the outbreak of war, he was at home in Normandy. When he reappeared in Paris in November, He was able to smile at some of the stories he was told about other people who had left. "Really, my dear fellow, you sent your wife off to the Aero? What a strange idea!" And so the winter passed. It was now springtime, and Paris had never looked so lovely. There was something melancholy, tender and luminous about the atmosphere, such a rare and precious beauty that in spite of himself, Monsieur Rose kept putting off the day of his departure. It took the night of the 10th of June, finally, to make him leave. He had slept badly. The sirens had woken him twice, and although he had not got out of bed, his sleep had been shattered by their wailing, by the sound of his neighbours hurrying downstairs, and by anti-aircraft fire nearby. At dawn he fell deeply asleep, and dreamt that he was looking for something, he knew not what, in a strange house where there were scraps of wrapping paper all over the floor. Someone outside the room shouted at him to hurry up while he searched desperately for a very dear and precious object or person, which he could not find. He was in such anguish that when he woke up his heart was beating furiously. When he discovered what had happened in the night, he became very thoughtful. It was time to leave. Things were no better in Normandy. It was ridiculous, he knew. What danger threatened him in this peaceful countryside? In any case, it was not anxiety he felt, but a kind of sadness. He was out of place in this world. He was a survivor, in fact, of a species that had almost disappeared. His habits and his tastes were leftovers from another era. Then, with one bound, the war had pounced on Monsieur Rose's peaceful retreat. Once more he had to leave. All his silver, books, valuables, and gold were now in chaos. Some were buried in the garden, and the rest piled into the car when Monsieur Rose finally decided to go.
"We should have left yesterday," said Robert, the chauffeur.
He was a short, ginger-haired, puny man who was exempt from military service. He drove well and did not seem to be dishonest, but Monsieur Rose could barely tolerate him. He was off-hand, if not insolent, in his manner. They drove all day. When evening came, Monsieur Rose was hungry. He was surprised that in the midst of such a disaster he could feel such normal, healthy emotions.
"Stop as soon as you see a village," he said to the chauffeur.
He could only see the back of Robert's neck. He said nothing, but his big red ears quivered, and without saying a word he managed to express so much disapproval that Monsieur Rose went purple with anger and shouted,
"Stop at once! I'm hungry!"
"And what is Monsieur going to eat? I can't see a restaurant."
"I can see a farm. At times like these," Monsieur Rose said, "one shouldn't make difficulties."
"It's not difficult to stop," smirked Robert. The car had been stuck for an hour in an unimaginably bad traffic jam. Monsieur Rose replied, "Get out of the car and run to that house. Buy whatever you can, bread, ham, fruit. Oh, yes, and a bottle of mineral water. I'm dying of thirst."
"So am I," said Robert, and climbed out of the car.
"Well," thought Monsieur Rose, "I'll get even with him tomorrow." Tomorrow. Where would he be tomorrow? Every section of the road hid dangers. He had heard that Rouen was burning. What would have happened to his house? Perhaps it was now nothing more than ashes. Strangely, however, as the hours went by, he thought less and less about what he had left behind. If he had lost everything, so be it. He still had his life. His life would be saved. Robert came back empty-handed.
"There's nothing."
"What do you mean, nothing? There are people living there."
"They're packing. If Monsieur doesn't believe me, he can go and look for himself."
Monsieur Rose was already getting out of the car.
"I certainly will." I'm sure you talk to them rudely and disagreeably. You don't refuse to give a bit of bread to your neighbour, and anyway, he finished angrily, I'm not asking for charity.
He made his way with difficulty through the cars trapped bumper to bumper. Their headlights were off. People's heads were tilted back as their eyes anxiously followed a shadow flitting from one star to another. Was it a cloud or an enemy plane? He thought he could hear the noise of an engine, but it was just the constant, muffled sound of the crowd. Footsteps, voices, bicycles being wheeled over stones on the road, the stifled, gasping breaths of thousands of people. Rather more quickly than he would normally have done, he walked up the path to the farm. Robert had not been lying. An old woman stood at the door, ready to flee, two children in her arms and two more clinging to her skirt. The kitchen cupboard was open and empty.
"There's nothing, monsieur. I'm sorry. Look, we only have a little dry sausage for ourselves and some milk for the children, that's all. We're leaving now."
Monsieur Rose apologized and retraced his steps.
"I'm going to have trouble finding Robert," he thought.
From the top of the slope, all the cars looked the same, with their mattresses fixed to the roof. He could no longer tell which was his. He walked on and called out, "Robert! Robert!" At first, his voice was strong and forceful. Then it became anxious, then frightened, then shaky and pleading. No one replied. Robert had abandoned him. He had gone with the car, the trunks, the silver, and the clothes. Finally, out of breath, Monsieur Rose collapsed onto the grass. As he clutched his chest, his hand touched his wallet, and he felt calmer.
"This has simply been a difficult night to get through. I'll report Robert first thing in the morning."
All he had to do now was to get to a town or a village.
But how?
Everywhere he looked, the road was packed with cars, lorries, three-wheelers, with sidecars and carts, all inching slowly forward. The parcels, boxes, prams and bicycles piled on top of them looked like rickety scaffolding towers. There was nowhere to sit, nothing to hold on to. No. There was no room for Monsieur Rose, and the crowd of pedestrians was already sweeping him along.
"Well then, damn it, I'll walk," he said out loud.
"Has your car been pinched, monsieur?" asked a young man walking beside him. "It's my bike that's gone."
At first, Monsieur Rose did not answer. Normally he did not talk to strangers. He looked at the young man, who must have been 16 or 17, but was so well built that Monsieur Rose thought to himself he could be useful. The young man could, after all, find Monsieur Rose something to eat or somewhere to stay. Monsieur Rose said eventually,
"Yes, my driver thought it a good joke to abandon me. But what about you?"
"Oh, someone asked me to lend a hand repairing a flat tire. I left my bike in a ditch, and when I went back it had gone."
"Have you come a long way?"
"Oh, from my school, 50 kilometres away. We were bombed."
"What about your family?"
"Oh, they're in the country, near Tours."
"Are you planning to join them?"
"I set off hoping to do so, but I have to tell you, monsieur, that I've changed my mind now. I'm 17, I can serve my country. As I said to my father at the beginning of the war, now people must make a choice between leading a heroic life or an easy one."
"The choice has already been made for me," muttered Monsieur Rose bitterly.
"Of course, at your age, monsieur, it's hard, but I thought I'd enlist. Every man ought to fight."
"What's your name, young man?" asked Monsieur Rose.
"Marc. Marc Beaumont."
They went on in silence for a while. They walked for hour after hour. Monsieur Rose's painful feet could hardly carry him.
"Lean on me, monsieur," the boy said. "You've had enough."
"I need to rest."
They tumbled into a ditch, and instantly the young man fell asleep. However, Monsieur Rose was at an age when exhaustion overstimulates the mind and drives sleep away.
"What a nightmare," he said mechanically. "What a nightmare."
The June night was soon over. In the morning, they set off again. There was no food to be had and nowhere to stay. After 48 hours, with his crumpled suit and dusty shoes, Monsieur Rose, who had not washed or shaved for 2 days, looked like a tramp.
"I suppose we'll carry on like this on foot until we reach Tours," Marc Beaumont said.
In fact, towards evening, they were picked up by a passing lorry. Some women who had been evacuated from a Parisian factory were sheltering under its wet tarpaulin. They had brought folding stools with them, on which they sat, motionless, hunching their backs against the rain, guarding parcels at their feet and children on their laps. Monsieur Rose and Marc Beaumont were allocated a stool between them. After a few hours, they had to give up their places to some children who were picked up from the edge of a field. They carried on walking, slept again, found some eggs in an abandoned farm which they swallowed raw, and dragged themselves on. In a village, some soldiers gave them food and told them to leave at once as there was going to be fighting. They would not allow Marc to join them.
"Not men we need, sonny, it's equipment."
Monsieur Rose and Marc set off again. Marc, at least, was able to sleep. But Monsieur Rose found only brief moments of rest and oblivion between nightmares. He looked at his companion closely. Marc provoked an irritable and affectionate pity in him. He was forever ready to carry a child, pick up a fallen parcel, or give away his meagre share of food whenever he found any. On the fifth day, he lost his watch. Monsieur Rose laughed at him.
"Well, of course, if you will run into the woods looking for some woman's bag, if at least she'd been pretty, that's how you let your bicycle be stolen. You're always going to be robbed in life." "Oh, monsieur," said Marc, "I won't be the only one."
He laughed. He could laugh still. He was even thinner. He was pale and hungry, yet he laughed.
"What does it matter, monsieur? A bicycle might have saved your life. Oh, I'll get out of this somehow." "Of course you will. I hope I will, too. Well, I can't imagine what state I'll be in."
They continued south towards the Loire. One night there was a shout of,
"Run for your life!"
and several bombs fell. Marc and Monsieur Rose were lying on the ground in the shelter of a little wall. Monsieur Rose was scrabbling at the earth with his nails, as if he wanted to hide underneath it. Then he felt Marc's hand on his shoulder, a firm, gentle, but still childlike hand which patted him shyly and affectionately. The plane went away. No one had been hurt. In a low voice, Monsieur Rose said,
"This is too much for me. I can't face it."
"Oh, we'll be fine, though. You'll see," said Marc, trying to laugh.
"But you're 17. You're not afraid of death. You don't love life at 17. I may be poor, old and weak, the world may be in ruins, but I still want to live."
They set off again. There was a second air raid. Marc sheltered Monsieur Rose with his body. He was injured, but Monsieur Rose was unharmed. He bandaged his young companion as best he could, and they went on walking. At last, the bridges of the Loire were in sight. Suddenly, Monsieur Rose collapsed.
"I can't walk any further. I'd rather die here."
"I can't carry on either," said Marc.
Both of them, the old man and the boy, stayed where they were, in a heap by the side of the road, watching the Loire glinting in the sunshine and the flood of refugees going past. Then, suddenly galvanized, he stood up. Someone was calling his name.
"Monsieur Rose?" Is that you, Monsieur Rose?
He saw a face he knew at a car window. He could not put a name to it. What did it matter? It was a man with a car. Overloaded, of course, full of parcels, women and children like all the others, but at least it was a car.
Do you have room for me? He called out. My car was stolen. I've been walking since Rouen. For pity's sake, take me.
Inside the car, they consulted one another. A woman cried out,
Impossible!
Another woman said,
They're going to blow up the bridges over the Loire. They won't be able to get across.
She leant towards Monsieur Rose, saying,
Get in. I've no idea how, but just get in.
Monsieur Rose was about to climb in when he remembered Mark.
Make room for this young man, too. Out of the question, my poor friend. I won't leave him, said Monsieur Rose.
He was so tired that his voice sounded faint and distant to his own ears, as if it were someone else's.
I can't abandon him.
At that moment, someone shouted,
The bridges are going to go up!
The car accelerated away. Monsieur Rose closed his eyes. It was over. He had lost his life. Why? For this child who meant nothing to him? He heard the voice of a woman beside him, shouting,
There are people on it! People! There are cars!
In the frightful chaos and confusion, the bridge had been blown up too soon. So had the refugees' cars, including the one which Monsieur Rose had refused to get into. Pale and trembling, he fell down next to Mark, barely realizing that his life had just been restored to him.
David Horovitch was reading Monsieur Rose by Irène Nemirovsky. It was abridged and produced by Elizabeth Allard. Well, a very warm welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall for this prom from the Russian National Orchestra and conductor Andrei Boryeko. Just one piece left on the programme tonight. It is Tchaikovsky's Third Suite. Music full of poetry inspired by walks in the woods of Ukraine. The piece didn't start out as a suite at all. Early in 1844, Tchaikovsky's thoughts turned towards composing a new symphonic work. But writing symphonies was no easy matter, particularly in Russia, where they were seen as too German to be truly national or commendable. In Vienna, critics saw Tchaikovsky as irredeemably Russian and parochial. At home, he was accused of being too cosmopolitan. So, by that summer of 1884, Tchaikovsky was itching to write a new piece, but paralysed by feelings of doubt about his own skill as a composer, as well as the wider questions of what Russian music should be. He spent the summer months at Kaminka, at the estate of his sister and brother-in-law, Sasha and Lev Davidov. While there, he kept a meticulous diary, and the entries for this period return over and over again to Tchaikovsky's anxieties about this new piece. In the end, he hit on the idea of an orchestral suite, just as lyrical, just as effective, only half the difficulty of working on a completely new symphony. For tonight's conductor, the work occupies a unique place in Tchaikovsky's music.
If it's not the symphony, it's not the suite either. For me, it's some new genre which doesn't have a name. It's something between symphony and suite. It's not the music written for the occasion. It's very intimate, and he's speaking to us about the same large problems in his life, about his difficulties to be different and his wish to be like everybody else. In this piece, and especially in the first movement and in the waltz, you definitely can hear it. It's one of his many musical confessions.
Andrei Boryeko. Well, Tchaikovsky's diaries certainly give an intimate picture of what everyday life was like for the composer at Kamenka. Many of the entries focus on Tchaikovsky's 13-year-old nephew, Bob Davidov, the object of his uncle's extreme attention, even obsession. It's unclear just what the relationship was between the two of them, but we know Tchaikovsky was recovering from his disastrous marriage and trying to come to terms with his homosexuality. It was against all of this background that Tchaikovsky wrote his third suite. So, Andrei Borieko returning to the stage at the Royal Albert Hall for Tchaikovsky's third suite with the Russian National Orchestra.
Thank you. music full of inspiration and hope, warmth and summer sunlight. Tchaikovsky's Third Suite, a performance here at the Proms by the Russian National Orchestra, conducted by Andrei Borieko. The concertmaster tonight, Alexei Bruni. And the Russian National Orchestra celebrating their 20th birthday this season. Applause for section principals now, the oboist Vitaly Nazarov. All the members of the orchestra on their feet. Well, tonight's conductor, Andrei Borieko, first got to know this orchestra around 1997-98. He had been working abroad. He'd heard so much about them, he told me, about this group of young renegades who'd got together to try something completely new for Russian orchestras, to set up from scratch a world-class group operating completely independently from government support. By the time I arrived, Borieko told me, these guys were playing in their perfect peak condition. And as we said earlier, 9 years since they performed together. Tomorrow they're off to Edinburgh, where they're doing Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto. The soloist there, Vadim Repin. And Shostakovich's 15th symphony, which Borieko tells me they've got just 1 hour to rehearse. And applause now for the horns, the trumpets, the whole brass section on their feet. All the winds too. Beautiful woodwind playing tonight. That rich, wonderful Russian sound. And I thought an incredible flautist Maxim Ritsov, and the concertmaster on his feet too, Alexei Bruni. So that is it for this evening. I will be back on Radio 3 for Susie Klein's Sunday Morning. That's at 10 this Sunday. I do hope you can join me. Meanwhile, here at the Proms tomorrow night, the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra are here with conductor Martin Brabant and more Tchaikovsky, the Second Symphony, known as the Little Russian. 7:30 p.m. live as ever here on BBC Radio 3. But for now, it's time to hand you back over to Broadcasting House and to Jonathan Swain.
Susie, thank you very much. Susie Klein there at the Royal Albert Hall. And as well as the BBC iPlayer for listening again via the Radio 3 website, just to say there's another chance to hear tonight's Prom broadcast again here on BBC Radio 3 in 2 weeks' time on Wednesday afternoon, the 1st of September at 2:40. That's Wednesday afternoon, the 1st of September at 2:40. Also, if you'd like to submit a review of tonight's Prom, then just go to bbc.co.uk/proms and click on share.
On Breakfast each morning through the summer prom season, we'll be bringing you the Henry Wood Proms Novelties, pieces of music that Sir Henry Wood introduced to proms audiences for the very first time, going right the way back to the first season in 1895. There are lost gems and works that have become great classics over time. The Henry Wood Novelties in Breakfast on Radio 3 every morning from 7.
Well, back to this evening, and in 20 minutes' time, how far would you go for a dance? Judith Macrell visits choreographers working in Britain and Ireland and asks them how wide they cast their imaginations to make innovative dance theatre. That's at 9:45 tonight. Until then, another offering from romantic Russia, though not in the form you usually hear it. Rimsky-Korsakov's Spanish Caprice is best known in its multicoloured orchestral version. Well, here it is in black and white. The two pianists are Arto Pizzaro and Vita Panomariovaite.
Thank you. Thank you.
Rimsky-Korsakov's Capriccio Espagnol in Rimsky's own arrangement for piano duo. The two pianists there, Arta Pizarro and Vita Panomariovaite. Tchaikovsky's None But the Lonely Heart, sung there by Olga Borodina with the pianist Larisa Gergieva. Well, just a mention of this week's Through the Night programmes, if you like Radio 3's company in the small hours, most of them this week setting off with Nights in Poland. Recent Polish performances of mostly Polish music. Chopin's there in some of them, but more often than not, he's the elephant in the room, as the saying goes. In other words, there's plenty of music by his lesser-known Polish contemporaries, Dobzhinsky, for example, and a few of Chopin's Polish successors, too, Szymanowski among them. Tonight, Chopin's second piano sonata played on a piano from Chopin's time. Also from Chopin's time, show-stopping arias by that tenor, composer, diplomat and great-nephew of the Polish king, Józef Poniatowski, and the violin concerto and a symphony by composers whose names will probably only be familiar if you come from Poland, Felix Janowitz, for example. There's also a bravura set of variations by Karol Lipinski, one of the Polish violin virtuosos, in fact a man who'd met and played duos with the great Paganini. That's Through the Night here on Radio 3 from 1 o'clock tonight. It's just gone a quarter to ten, and now we've another chance to hear the first of two programmes in which modern dance makers describe the extremes of physicality, violent, cerebral, ideal or earthy, that they go for their art. Dance critic Judith Macrell asks, how far would you go for a dance?
5 years ago, I was in London's Tate Modern, watching a performance choreographed by Merce Cunningham. We were being allowed to move freely among the dancers, watching up close the intricate and extraordinary ways that Cunningham has found for shaping the human body. Above us, on the walkway spanning the hall, Sat Cunningham himself, confined to his wheelchair, but looking down with eagle eyes at his own creation. There have been other figures, like Cunningham, who've radically changed the art of dance. Tricia Brown, who's stripped it back to its minimalist essentials. Pina Bausch, who's opened it out to create teemingly surreal worlds. William Forsythe, who's taken ballet into the new millennium with his fiercely deconstructed rewrites of the classical language. The shadows cast by all these men and women loom large, and the challenge for younger choreographers is how to move beyond them, how to find new ways for the body to move, new material to express. To consider what that challenge means, I've spoken to four choreographers working in Britain and Ireland today. First is Wayne McGregor, who occupies a unique position in the art form, both at the cutting edge of modern dance, with his own company Random, and also at the heart of the ballet establishment as choreographer in residence at the Royal. Wayne's a choreographer who's always pushed his dancers to physical extremes, his style a contrast of shearing angles and seemingly boneless fluidity. But the influences that shape his work are also very cerebral. For the last few years, Wayne's been collaborating with neuroscientists on experiments in mind-body coordination. He's also used state-of-the-art computer technology to stage his works. In Sulphur, a host of digitally generated figures shimmered among his live dancers like visitors from another planet. In Nemesis, his company were transformed into some kind of super race through the freakishly articulate mechanical limbs that were attached to their arms. Sometimes Wayne's choreography inhabits a world that isn't just modern, it reflects a future some of us haven't yet imagined.
I mean, I've had my company almost 18 years, and what I've realised is that in the early part of the time that I was making, I was obsessed with what could the body do. I was trying to establish some kind of syntax or grammar or vocabulary for the body, which I felt in some way helped me describe some of the things that I wanted to. So the early experiments with kind of like technology were very much about pushing language and pushing style. So one of the very early programs that we used to work with was a program called Poser, which is a 3D animation program. Poser does this amazing thing where it's used for gaming. It's used to create animations for gaming contexts. But the body can very, very easily misbehave. So you can literally dislocate the shoulder and put it completely in a different place. You can literally rotate the head 360 degrees. So it doesn't have the normal kind of conventions of the body. Now, obviously, you then have an animation figure that does something that couldn't literally be able to be done. But when you see it, it gives you a fantastic opportunity to be able to work out how you might be able to realise something like that, because you have the visual picture of it, but in a different way. So rather than my head obviously moving around 360 degrees, I could perhaps make a trio which allowed that central person to be able to have that kind of behaviour.
So whereas, say, the early choreographers used to go to the great masters, the paintings, to look at tableaus and figures for inspiration, you went to gaming programmes and, as you say, animated figures.
Yeah, I think it's very, very close in a way.
Then you took that whole fascination with technology further and became fascinated by science. Could you talk a bit about that journey into science, into scientific knowledge?
I mean, I think it's something to do with this idea that choreography for me is very much about physical thought. For me to understand more about how my body organises itself, I need to know a little bit more about how the brain organises itself. I talk a lot with the scientists that we work with, that they work a lot with people who have some kind of deficit, some kind of like brain trauma. And I talked to them very early on about this idea that choreographers or dancers have an excess of kinesthetic intelligence. So it's very easy then to see how my proprioception, my sense of my own body, would be much more detailed and articulate than probably a normal person's. And that gives you a very good yardstick in which to be able to think about how the brain then is working in relationship to the body. And that's where that curiosity came from. It really came from that idea of how do you explore physical thought and how do these two things work together. And once I start to understand how they work together, how might I be able to disrupt them or disconnect them? The scientists call it give perturbations to that relationship.
But can you then talk through how that affects your choreography? In a way, I can see how you would be an absolute goldmine to a neuroscientist, but how did that feed back into your choreography and into the dancers themselves?
It sets you a set of parameters from which you make your piece. Now, without this information, the piece wouldn't look the same. So even if people aren't reading that that piece is about those things, without that set of circumstances for making, that piece wouldn't look like that.
Boom, day, dance, day, 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 da, day, boom, day, dun, day, da, da, dun, da, day, keep going, bum, day.
Infra, the new work that Wayne has just created for the Royal Ballet, doesn't have any obvious connection with science. Set to a haunting score by Max Richter, it's a deeply emotional piece that imagines the inner lives of a group of strangers. But when Wayne is rehearsing his dancers, he doesn't talk about feeling or character.
Well, do one and then half.
Oh, one and then half?
Do then one, then half. Rather than half, then one.
Fingers clicking, brain whirring, he delivers a stream of movement instructions that transform the studio into a flickering energy field. All the time, he seems to be accessing a huge and very eclectic data bank of physical information.
And then one of the projects we're working on now, which I find really fascinating, and we're going to America to do a four-week research project based around this, is what is a thing called distributed cognition. What happens when one or two, when two or more people think about the same problem? And of course, in dance, you do that all the time. I set a task with the dancers, I'm solving the problem, they're solving the problem. We've got a shared kind of intellectual space in which this improvisation or something happens. But what's actually, what is the dynamic of that exchange? And what we're hoping to find out is what's actually happening when you're doing this shared thinking, and two, how might you be able to improve it?
So when you're equipping yourself with these new tasks of looking at choreography, at the process of making choreography, do you find yourself becoming a more fluent or articulate choreographer, or does it bewilder you with the sense of extra possibilities and infinity of possibilities?
I mean, I think it does bewilder you, because I think then there are loads more options. But it's very practical, because we've worked a little bit with this great camera called SenseCam with Microsoft, which is a camera which takes a picture every 30 seconds. It's a wearable camera, basically. And they're developing it for use with people who have Alzheimer's in a way to kind of reload memory, improve the memory over a period of time. But what's interesting about wearing this thing in the process, I've been wearing it during my rehearsal days, when you watch back your 24 hours on this camera, you realise how much you've forgotten. There are moments, because it's taking accidentally, that one, you don't remember, and two, you've not actually seen. Then you can, those things that were absent to you in the moment of making, you can then use.
And I know you're also working on the idea of an artificial choreographic intelligence.
Yeah.
Is this going to make you redundant?
No, it'll never make me redundant. I mean, I think I'm a firm believer that I just don't think anything will ever replace the live experience of live bodies dancing in front of a live audience. I mean, I feel passionate about that. But what we're trying to do is build an artificially intelligent agent or series of agents that think choreographically. So in the way that we've been talking, it would have its own kind of sense of proprioception, its own sense of itself. It would be able to make spatial decisions like a choreographer. These programs would be able to order events algorithmically, so with code, basically. And the idea is that they wouldn't make dances, that they would make other things. So they could generate architecture, they could generate music, they could generate graphics that we could use for improvisation. But the idea is that I would have a choreographic problem in the studio that I would be solving with the dancers, and these choreographic agents would be solving the problem with choreographic intelligence. So not just computer intelligence, but with how choreographers think about solving a problem, and it would output something that we could then use.
We've talked quite a lot about the processes of choreographing, the sort of internal cognitive processes. Mm. What about the emotional processes? Do you explore with your dancers what they're feeling as they're moving, what kind of emotions they're hoping to convey to an audience?
I am notoriously secretive about what information I give to the dancers about the piece. And I like this idea, again, that kind of emotionality emerges from language, and that then is transmitted to a member of an audience. But this, I've realised, comes from an exceptional dancer. So if you give Alina Kojikaru a particular type of phrase, She embodies material straight away. She has an amazing facility to transform that technical series of moves into something other. And so I kind of almost give the injection, the language, the thing that triggers off this emotional relationship to the language, but it's for the dancer to help kind of transform it. Having said that, over the last few years, I've been very interested in this idea of metaphor and actually what I am kind of communicating and how much I would like to have the dancers just push this kind of emotional content. I think when you mention science, people immediately take a step back. They go, oh. Then if you, and this is again, we've learned this from cognition, if you then colour it, and I've got a very particular aesthetic in work, if you work with a very minimal aesthetic or very steely blues or white sidelight, you're a step back again. If you work with very unfamiliar material, which is kind of dysfunctional for the eye, or you might work with visual noise, and there's not a particularly explicit relationship the audience immediately understand with music, they're back again. And so all of these things just place the audience slightly further and further back from the work. And what I'm trying to do now is work in understanding how I can keep these elements of the aesthetics, which I find really communicate the thing that is really deep within me, but that also brings the audience closer.
You talk about your work as a, in a sense, a process, and each work is a mark on the route. Does that mean you wouldn't really want your earlier works to be revived in the repertory? Are they gone once they're done for you?
It's an interesting question, because I've been asked a lot if I could restage my ballets all over the world. Returning to pieces really frustrates me, because they, even though intellectually I understand that they're a moment in time, when I watch them, I immediately know what I would do to transform them. And if someone else stages it and then you go back and see it, I just feel, at the moment, it just doesn't sit comfortably with me. I would rather be engaged with the making process. And when I go to the studio, I absolutely love making. That's my favourite time, more than the performances or the dinners or the travelling the world. It's actually the time in the studio with the dancers.
In terms of your dancers specifically, but I guess all dancers, I mean, what are their limits of either risk or of danger or pain or difficulty to which you wouldn't push either yourself or your dancers?
All the dancers that I work with are hugely intelligent human beings and have a voice. What you find with these dancers is that they want to push their physical limits in the same way that an Olympic athlete wants to push theirs. Would we be satisfied with a sprinter running the same time as a sprinter of 30 years ago in terms of the development of sport? No, probably not. And I've got a feeling in dance it's the same, that actually expressivity or creativity of a body is also about pushing its limits. And the more we understand, again, from sports science, the more we understand from how the body works in terms of injury repair, injury prevention, all of these things, the body is becoming more and more, I would say, technological.
If Wayne McGregor expands his horizons towards the technological future, Javier de Frutos looks backwards to ancient rituals of blood and lust and to culturally taboo areas of violence and self-display. The Venezuelan choreographer began his career as a soloist, and he seemed to be on a mission to push himself through every inhibition. Much of the material he used was nakedly biographical. Much of the time, he actually danced naked. His works may be funny, exuberant, even lyrical, but a quality of violence always forces its way to the surface. One of his recent works, Los Picadoros, came as close to human bullfighting as its title suggests, with a cast of six dancers who goaded each other into a violent and eventually fatal sexual frenzy. That violence was very carefully choreographed. However, in Javier's earlier work, Grass, the pain the dancers inflicted on each other was real. A sexual triangle for two men and one woman, it ended with Javier flagellating himself until his back was red and raw.
You catch the two men slightly post-coital, but a post-coital that is not necessarily clear whether it has been consensual or in their ignorance and in their passion, they have managed to damage each other very seriously physically, to virtually rape each other to death. That's the end of the piece, an extraordinary bloodbath.
I talked to Javier at the Century Club in London's West End.
I started coming here while I was working on Cabaret down the road on Shaftesbury Avenue.
Going back to when you were a dancer, what actually was the impulse that led you to start making dances for yourself rather than just staying as a dancer performing somebody else's vision?
I think that's probably it. It's somebody else's vision. I hadn't been asked by any choreographer to use nudity, and the idea terrified me. But I knew that it was something that I needed to experience. Stupid stuff like dying on stage. God knows I was desperate to have a fabulous death on stage. All these experiences they were not part of the vision of the choreographer that I was working with. So I guess that I created that vision for myself. I've done the nudity, I've done the blood, I've done self-flagellation and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Emotionally, I found myself very uninhibited once I broke those physical barriers.
I think for me, one of the most shocking works that you've ever made is the trio Grass, which you made, I think, in 1997.
Yeah.
And it was set to music from Puccini's Madame Butterfly. There was very graphically emotional and sexual physical contact. And beyond that, an extraordinary intuitive reaction to the music. I mean, it was about Puccini, even though it was also about seeing you three dance yourselves to death on stage.
I just loved the music all my life. I like especially that version, the Callas version is very special. A great lover of Greek tragedy. And very early on, I remember having seen Peter Stein and La Chubin did a performance of the Oresteia on a Greek theater. And I remember the first thing that the performers did, they come with buckets of pig's blood and they would wash the walls. And that was the decor. And I found between the smell and the colors and seeing those colors coagulate and change, it repulsed you and at the same time it attracted you. It was just an extraordinary thing to do. So I became a great lover. I've always been a great lover of theater, period. I probably like theater more than I like dance, unfortunately. It would make my life easier if I like dance a bit more.
The extremes to which Javier pushes himself and his dancers may sound excessive, but he actually choreographs within very rigorous structures, structures which are partly dictated by his musical scores. He may use colourfully unfamiliar versions of some scores. With others, he may start the music with a startling suddenness, as if he says God had just put the needle down on the record.
I kind of had to find something that would accompany me, especially during the solo period, because it's very lonely. So music made my work feel less lonely. But also because there is a logic to music that kind of unravels, and it makes the work in a strange way more accessible.
Is there a limit beyond which you wouldn't push yourself now as a choreographer?
As a choreographer, I would not choreograph a work in which people physically hurt themselves on stage. And the willingness to go emotionally to an extreme, the word willingness, is key to this. When we did Picadores, we brought Terry King, the fight director, because I wanted for it to be as realistic as possible, yet it's probably physically the safest work of the whole repertoire. Because in Grass, I did it for real. And I'm still suffering consequences of that. But with Picadores, it wasn't. And it was far more effective by not being it.
This, I have to say, is your version of Les Noces, which many people describe as Stravinsky meets Fight Club.
Yeah.
And it was on stage a really concentrated bout of violence, of choreographed fighting, as you say.
Yeah. It was a special commission for the Venice Biennale last year. The theme of the festival that year was Eros. So I guess when they had to commission somebody to do something about sex, like, who shall we call? And I went back to the version of the Pobrovsky Ensemble. The version of Les Noces was recorded with the original villagers. He went to the villages. So all those Mongol-like sounds is really a visceral sound. It suddenly became far more violent in my ear. The thing that I thought about the closest was probably Bacon, Francis Bacon. You can frame that incredible amount of violence. If you frame it, then you have to see it differently. I have said this to dancers many times, that I love the idea of method dancing. Once you enter into the work, you know, from the minute one until minute 30 or 1 hour, you need to finish and I hate using the word journey, but I have no other word for it. You need to finish the journey, because if you feel that you haven't completed it on stage, you go to your dressing room a very, very sour performer. And that feeling of defeat, having invested physically so much not to come to that climax, it's an incredibly frustrated thing to have as a performer. And the audience can see it. You cannot fake that.
The Israeli choreographer, Hofer Schechter, also draws on dark, conflicted personal experience. Yet the results on stage can feel more abstract, even philosophical. As a trained drummer, Hofesh unusually composes his own music, and his densely rhythmic scores function almost like aural landscapes. His style of movement is tough and visceral, but also tightly patterned. Hofesh came to Britain 6 years ago, and success followed fast. Amongst his younger audience, he's best known for the dance segment he choreographed for the Channel 4 drama Skins. On stage, his most celebrated work is In Your Rooms, a piece that's almost existential in the questions it poses about the nature of identity.
The starting point was the mass and the individual. That was a starting point, and trying to create tension between the two and see which kind of emotions are going to come up. And I was trying to think about ways of achieving that tension. And then the idea of doing something as cinematic as I can imagine came up. Just snap from one situation to a completely different situation as fast as possible. So I could present a group of people doing something that will look like a mysterious ceremony. And I can just cut it off. And then 3 seconds later, you just see a person on his own, overwhelmed, you know. So a lot of questions went through my head at the time. What was first? Who decided how things are? Is it that the individual is following what the mass decided, but the mass is built out of individuals? So what is driving it? Is it random? A lot of questions like that. You know, they all just went deeper and deeper and darker and darker.
What's interesting is that you have these very dark moments of emotion embodied in the movement physically. Some of it's quite harrowing, but also your pieces are incredibly tightly structured.
Yeah. In Your Rooms, in Purpose, I wanted to create really strong structures. And I think the more the structure looks kind of like solid, the more the individual appears fragile, and the structure is so firm, is so strong. It's like a well-oiled machine full of confused animals.
And there are quite militaristic images in your work too. Mm. The hard lines of it and some of the arm gestures seem very much based on, you know, you think of soldiers or you think of a band of revolutionaries. Did you do military service?
Yes, I was in the army. I had a special status in the army. They do it for people that their career might be hurt if they're just losing 3 years of their lives doing the army. So I had this special status as a dancer. All the same, being in the army is a very strange thing. Before I got this status as a dancer, I actually got it a month into being in the army. And it was shocking for me. I think the shock is the loss of freedom. You don't decide anything. It's that you feel like you gave your soul to someone else. And that feeling is quite horrible, because it's in conflict with the best feeling a person possibly can have, which is that you are special and that you have something special to give and unique. I don't believe in God, but I remember thinking, oh my God, like, how do I get out of here?
And do you think it's left its mark in your work?
Yes. The conflict I spoke about before, the I'm free but I'm not, that left a very strong mark on me. I think all the double meanings and the double messages you're getting from the same, apparently the same place, the same society, that creates this electric shortcut in your brain, you know, that left its mark. I think the just not knowing what's real or not, what's true or not, what's necessary or not.
So why did you leave Israel to work?
Well, I left Israel twice, actually. The first time it was just really the travel bug, the traveling bug, and to study drums in Paris. And we were just looking for ourselves, really. And then we went back to Israel, but somehow the Twin Towers fell. And it created a kind of ripple effect also in Israel, that it was just, you know, pouring from windows and from the doors of your house into your house, into your life, where, you know, you're walking down the street, it's shouting out of newspapers. And it was in a place of my life where I just wanted to deal with art. So we just decided to go for another, you know, for another trip in Europe, and we ended up in London. I also have to say I have dual nationality. I have an Israeli nationality and a German nationality. I'm not very much into dividing the world into countries, and I felt, well, maybe I can take the freedom to say I'm a citizen of the world. I could feel the urge to create. I could feel, you know, I could feel also a lot of fear. And for whatever reason, coming here and finding my cocoon and my place helped something open up.
Hoffisch made his first work in 2003, but word of his talent spread, and it was in 2006 that he was commissioned to create In Your Rooms. This project was funded by three different London theatres, and it was structured so that he could present the work over three different stages. Hoffisch was able to learn lessons in editing, highlighting and presentation he'd otherwise have taken years to acquire.
If I want to drag people so low down, I must give them something up there to hang on. So I had to, in a way, put kind of like more noisy and hard and groovy moments so that it will suddenly put into focus how lonely one person on a stage is.
Your dance is quite cathartic for you. I mean, do you deal with your own feelings of loneliness and hopelessness and conflict?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I do feel that I relive, I don't know if it's experiences, but emotions. The work will always reflect something that is happening inside me. There is a lot of struggle, I think, and there is a lot of conflict and a lot of duality in everything. It's work that examines itself, and I think I'm a person that examines myself all the time. So it's all the time in between wanting to break free, whatever that may mean, which a lot of times connects to the animalistic place of a person, and the judgmental side, which is the language that we invented, the terms, the definitions. And this struggle is really interesting, and I think it also it influences our physicality in an interesting way.
So when you're working with the dancers, do you give them imagery to work with?
We're not working from a visual point of view. We're not working with mirrors and trying to achieve shapes. We are working with, I think, a lot with feelings, actually, finding a very small and humble place. That can be one feeling we work with, so finding a place where you feel very oppressed, a place where you're pushing against something. So it's about finding the right sensation.
Yeah. Now, the title of this programme is How Far Will You Go for a Dance? Do you feel that other aspects of your life have been sacrificed? Family, friends?
Don't have much family. Don't have many friends, so that's not a problem. I think time for myself is actually the thing that has been sacrificed the most, which is worrying, of course, because time with yourself is when creation happens.